participate in the things that we want to hear from you and that you would want to hear from the elders as well. Just recently, we began what would be kind of a scattered series on respect for authority. And in that lesson, we talked about the foundation of all authority, areas of application of authority, the resistance to direction, and the meaning of submission. And we suggested that we as the elders felt that we need to look at the question of submitting to authority in a number of areas. One of the points we made is that to reject and to rebel against authority in whatever form is an ultimate rejection of God. So whether it be rejecting the authority of parents or the husband or the employer or civil authorities or the elders, and decide I don't want to follow that direction and that leadership is a rejection ultimately of God. We talked about a number of areas of application, such as the authority of husbands, the authority of parents, the authority of the employer, the civil government, and that of elders. And we want to focus tonight on the authority of the husband. And look at 1 Peter chapter 3. Let's talk about submission to husbands, 1 Peter 3, 1 through 6. That's where our text will be taken. And so I encourage you to get a Bible open and mark 1 Peter 3. And we're going to be looking at verses 1 through 6. In fact, let's read them now and see what the text actually says. Wives, likewise, be submissive to your own husbands, that even if some do not obey the word, they without a word may be won by the conduct of their wives. When they observe your chaste conduct accompanied by fear. Do not let your adornment be the outward, merely outward, arranging the hair, wearing gold, or putting on fine apparel. Rather, let it be the hidden person of the heart, with the incorruptible beauty of a gentle and quiet spirit, which is very precious in the sight of God. For in this manner, in former times, the holy women who trusted in God also adorned themselves, being submissive to their own husbands. As Sarah obeyed Abraham, calling him Lord, whose daughters you are, if you do good, and are not afraid with any terror. Now, the first question that comes to mind is, why is that kind of instruction needed in our present day? We'll talk more about the context in which this sits in a few moments, but why is this needed in our present day to talk about wives submitting to their husbands? First, the feminist movement says the woman is not to submit to any man. For any reason. She is not to submit to his leadership. She is her own leader. She makes up her own mind. She is her own ruler. And so she is not to submit even to a husband. It is a 50-50 relationship. And she has equal authority in the home as does the husband if she chooses to be married. Secondly, there is a false notion in our world and even among some Christians that submission means that you are somehow a second-class person. That you are inferior to the person to whom you submit, and that is some kind of some subhuman kind of mentality that you would submit to the leadership of someone else. So this idea of a wife submitting to her husband is subhuman. That is like some kind of abuse, that is an inferiority relationship. And thirdly, may I suggest, and perhaps more closer to home, is the fact that there are some wives, even among God's people, who are indeed domineering, they are controlling, they are the ones who tell their husbands the way things will be, and as the old saying goes, they wear the pants in the family. It's not uncommon to find even among the people of God some woman who will give lip service to the idea that I am submissive to my husband, I am to be submissive to my husband, he is the leader, he is the head of the family, but when push comes to shove, she is the one that wears the pants. She tells the husband the way things ought to be. She's domineering and she's controlling and she's manipulative. And so consequently, she is indeed the leader within the family. And so that's why that kind of information would be needed. R.C.H. Linsky correctly said that all Scripture, in particular the New Testament, asks Christian wives to be subject to their husbands. And what is asked of the husbands should certainly make any wife's objection a delight instead of an infliction. He perhaps is talking about verse 7 of our context. That while verses 1 to 6 says she is to be submissive to her husband, if the husband would be the kind of husband that verse 7 describes him as being, it indeed would be a delight for her to say, I would willingly follow your leadership. which is what verses 1 to 6 is all about. We hear a lot about freedom in our society. And with reference to the role of women and the role of the church, we hear a lot about freedom, that she needs freedom. She needs her freedom in the home. And she is free to do what she wishes. I want to suggest to you the train has freedom to operate at its optimum as it remains within the limitations of the track. It is when the train is free from the limitations of the track that nothing functions as it is designed to do. Now let's personify the train, and you picture yourself as a train. Would you rather have the freedom of operating within the confines of the track? You can't just get off and wander through the fields. You can't go any direction that you want, but you have the freedom to run within the confines of the track. Or you decide, I think I want to be free from the track and do what I want, and then we have ultimate disaster. The same principle would apply to beautiful music. There is beautiful harmony in music only, that's only possible when the rules of harmony are followed. So whether you're singing a secular song or you're singing a religious song, if we sing and follow the rules of harmony and we stay within the confines and the limitation of the rules of harmony, then we have beautiful music. But consequently, when a person is free from those rules and say, I want freedom, I want to be able to break away from the rules of harmony. And so then one begins to sing in any key, at any tempo, and in any music, in any note, then we have complete disaster. Can you imagine if when we sing our invitation song that Evan starts off in one key and I decide, you know what, I don't like that key. I'm going to sing a different key and I'm going to sing a little slower than him. And someone else decides over here they're going to sing a little faster than him and we're going to sing different notes from him and even different words. The disarray that we have. Freedom only comes when we're staying within the confines of the rules. So back to our text in 1 Peter chapter 3. What is this text requiring? And furthermore, not only what does it require, but why does it require it? What is demanded? Why is it demanded? And how is it to be done? Is there anything in this text that says, here's how she's to go about it? Or does it just say, wives be submissive to husbands, that's it, and that's all there is to say about that, and so just do it? Or does it tell us how? And furthermore, what is the result of doing that? What if she does follow that? How different will her life be from some woman who doesn't do that? Does this text give any indication of that? So let's talk about submission to husbands. 1 Peter 3, 1 to 6. Here's the first point I want you to see. Let's talk about the command. Let's start with the text itself. And let's look at verse 1 and then verses 5 and 6. What does the text say as far as the command? Well, look at verse 1. Likewise, you wives, be submissive to your own husbands. That's a matter of fact of a commission. That is a matter of fact of a direction. That is an obligation laid down. Be submissive to your own husband. Let's go to verse 5. Verse 5, branching out from that saying, let's look at the end of verse 5, being submissive to their own husbands, that she's like women of old. Well, what is she going to do when she is like women of old? Following the command of verse 1, she'll be submissive to her own husbands. Let's look at verse 6. Sarah obeyed Abraham. Here's what he's talking about, being obedient like Sarah was to Abraham, calling him Lord, whose daughters you are if you do good and are not afraid with any terror. So first of all, I see what the text itself says. Let's talk about the example that he gives. I know what the text says. We're following this concept of the command. What is the command that's given? We'll talk about the reasons later. But what is the example that he gives? Well, he talks about Sarah in verse 6. Well, what does he say about Sarah? Well, in verse 6 he said, Sarah obeyed Abraham, calling him Lord. There's actually two things that are said that come back and are joined together and are connected as one. First of all, Sarah obeyed Abraham. That means she was submissive to him. That means she followed his direction. That means she followed his lead. That means she let him be the leader. She obeyed Abraham. But the text says she called him Lord. Let's go back. This must be referring to Genesis 18 and in verse 12. I don't think there was only one time that she did that. There's one time that is recorded. But certainly, if they lived to be the old age that they were, and she had this attitude toward Abraham, that wasn't the only time that she did that. But the text says at verse 12 that this is when the birth announcement came that Isaac would be born. And so Sarah laughed within herself, saying, "After I have grown old, shall I have pleasure, my Lord being old also?" Why did she call him Lord? That was not a title that she had, that it's Lord Abraham, but the word Lord simply means ruler. And so she is saying, he is my leader. I call him Lord out of respect, saying, he's my leader. So the two things, back to 1 Peter 3 and in verse 6, what's the example of Sarah? Sarah obeyed Abraham, and she referred to him as her leader, and that comes back together and joined as one, because she did revere him as her leader, she obeyed him. Let's talk about the meaning of that. I know what the text says. I know the example she gave, or that was given, of Sarah. Let's talk about the meaning. Let's talk about what that doesn't mean. Let's look at the context and come to an understanding. It doesn't mean somehow that she is inferior. How do you know? Well, let's look at verse 7. Likewise, you husbands, dwell with them according to understanding, giving honor to the wife as unto the weaker vessel, as being heirs together of the grace of life. The text says they're heirs together. In things that are really important, that is spiritual matters of being an heir to the grace of life, they're heirs together. They're on an equality one with the other. He is not superior to her. He is not lifted to a higher level than her. And so it doesn't mean somehow that she is inferior to him. There are a number of people to whom you submit that you're not inferior to. You submit to government rulers. We'll see that in this context here in a moment in chapter 2. That doesn't mean you are inferior to them. You're to submit to the leadership of elders. That doesn't mean you're inferior to elders. The same thing is true with reference to parents. It doesn't mean that she is a slave who obeys every whim of her master. That every time he hollers, she is to say yes, sir, and do whatever it is that is at his bidding. It's not some kind of master-slave relationship. In fact, verse 7 would forbid that. That he is honoring her. He holds her in high esteem. That he dwells with her according to understanding. He gives honor unto the wife as unto the weaker vessel. He holds her up as something precious and valuable and treats her as an equal together of the grace of life. It does not mean that she can have no input on decisions. And you say, how would you know? Well, Matthew chapter 19 and in verse 6 says they are one flesh. They have this close bond relationship. Can you imagine being one that is, you're taking two lives and you're blending them together as if they are functioning as one, and they are functioning as one. They're one in their mind and goal and their purpose and their aims, and yet she has no input on that. Nor does it mean that she could not be consulted about decisions that he makes. There may be some husbands that think, if I consult my wife, that somehow implies my weakness, so I'm not going to consult her at all. I'm going to make the demands and the decisions here. It doesn't mean she can't be consulted any more than elders leading doesn't mean that they cannot consult others who may not be qualified to be elders, but you consult them for their wisdom and for their input, as we're going to do next Lord's Day. Here's what it does mean. It does mean the husband bears responsibility for leadership and direction. I see that in the example of verse 6. That Sarah looked to Abraham as the ruler. He's my leader. He's the one that sets the pace for direction. He's the one that bears responsibility for this marriage and for this relationship. It is a burden of a responsibility that is laid upon his shoulders when he is the head of the house. But this text is directed in verses 1 to 6 to the wife. And so what it's saying is the husband is the one, not you, but it's the husband who bears the responsibility for leadership and direction. Furthermore, what that means is that she is to submit to and to follow his leadership and direction. So back to verse 1. Verse 1 says, likewise, you wives, be submissive to your own husbands. What does that mean? Well, in practicality, what that means is the husband bears the responsibility. Someone has to shoulder the responsibility and say, here's what's going to be done. Here's the direction the family's going to go. Here's what we're going to do. Here's what we're not going to do. He bears the responsibility of that. It means that she willingly submits and follows that leadership and direction. Listen to this one carefully. What that means is when there is a conflict, his decision must prevail. Otherwise, the passage is meaningless. What that means is that when they have a conflict and she says, I think we ought to do this, and he says, no, this is what where we ought to go. This is where we're going. Now, they should communicate and perhaps resolve their differences. But when there is a difference, it's not her wisdom that prevails. It must be his. Not because his is better. We're going to see that's not the case. Not in this context. It just simply means when there is a conflict, his decision prevails. If not, the passage becomes meaningless. Now, as one writer said, before we look at the exception to that, that here's the principle that is involved. If there's an old saying that says, if two people ride the same horse, somebody has to ride behind. And so two people are going to function together. Someone has to lead. And someone has to follow that leadership. And so is the husband going to follow her leadership? If so, then that's skewed from what God says. And so how's it going to take place? God says the husband is to lead and the wife is to follow his leadership. Let's talk about the exception to that. I know what the text says. I know the meaning. I know the example that was given. What about the exception? Well, here's a general principle in Acts chapter 5 and verse 29. We've talked about this many times before. This is Peter as he stood before the Sanhedrin and they were demanding him not to preach the gospel. And he said, we ought to obey God rather than men. Well, the principle involved, we ought to obey God over any man, husband, elder, civil leader. In other words, whatever direction that someone in authority gives to you that is in conflict with Scripture, our obligation, obviously, is to follow what God said. So if the husband directs her and says, you know what, you're not going to church today, she ought to go on to church and violate his command. And when he gives her some other direction and says, we're not going to do thus and so, when God has told her she's to do that, then she's to follow the direction of God. But furthermore, let's get a little closer to home. Let's look at Colossians 3 and in verse 18. In Colossians 3, which is parallel to the book of Ephesians, but this one goes a little step further than the book of Ephesians does at this juncture, at least in this phrase. Colossians 3 says, wives, submit to your own husbands as is fitting in the Lord. As is fitting in the Lord. What is the exception? That is, if it's not fitting in the Lord, she is to follow his direction. This harmonizes with Acts 5, by the way. She's to follow his leadership and his direction as long as it is in harmony with the Lord. And any time that it's out of harmony with the will of the Lord, she has to say, I'm not going to do that. I respect you, but I'm not going to do that. I'm going to do what the Lord told me to do. Now listen to this carefully as I suggest that the exception is not merely something she doesn't like. If she says, you know what, I'm going to follow your direction as long as I like that and I'm in agreement, but here is something I don't think we ought to be doing, and that's not the direction we ought to go, even though it's not a matter of right and wrong, it's a matter of judgment, I'm going to do what my judgment says. That's not the exception that's given in the text. But secondly, let's talk about the context. I know what the command is. What do we see about the command? I saw the text, the example, the meaning, the exception given to that. Let's talk about the context. That's very important. I want to begin in chapter 1 now. Let's back up. Now, the context would have to do with the entire book. Let's go back to chapter 1, verse 15 and 16. In verse 15, he said, as he who called you is holy, be holy in all of your conduct, because it is written, be holy, for I am holy. That's the theme, by the way, of the book of 1 Peter. I am convinced that's the theme. Every chapter relates somehow to being holy. And notice he says, in all of your conduct. Not just holy in your worship, not just holy in your daily devotion, but you're holy in all of your conduct. Be holy as a wife. Be holy as a husband. Be holy as a parent. Be holy as an employer, as an employee. As a civilian, as a citizen, be holy in all of your conduct. In every aspect. Now, what does it mean to be holy? It means to be set apart for the service of God. Things in the Old Testament that were holy, said to be holy. For example, the temple was said to be holy. It was set apart for, there was nothing special about the gold or the materials that went into the temple. But when it was holy, it means it was set apart for the service of God. And so if you were to be holy, you're set apart for the service of God. Because God's holy, whom we serve. It also has the idea of being pure. And so here is a book that is written about being holy in every aspect of your life, being pure in every aspect of your life, and in the middle of that he talks about duties and responsibilities of being holy. Like what? Well, let's go to chapter 2, for example, and let's begin at verse 13. We're coming to this a little bit later in just a second. But talk about submitting yourself to every ordinance of man. That has everything to do with your holiness, submitting to civil government. Look at beginning at verse 18. Be submissive to your masters. Submitting to those who are ruling over you, your masters. That has everything to do with your holiness. And so here her submission is a part of her being holy. If she is one saying, I'm not going to be submissive, I'll tell you what, I'm not going to submit to my husband at all, then she's not a holy wife. She wants to be holy. She wants to be set apart for the service of the Lord. Then she submits willingly to the leadership of her husband. It has everything to do with her holiness. The context bears that out. But there's a second thing about the context we need to pay attention to, and that is the context of submission. Before we even get to chapter 3. So let's back up to chapter 2. I said we'd come to that, so let's back up to chapter 2 and in verse 13. He's been talking about, before he ever gets to the wives, about submission. Look at chapter 2 and verse 13. Therefore submit yourselves to every ordinance of man for the Lord's sake, whether to the king as supreme, or to governors of those who are sent by him for the punishment of evildoers, for the praise of those who do good. For this is the will of God, he said, that in doing good you may silence the ignorance of the foolish men. In verse 17, honor all people, love the brotherhood, fear God, and honor the king. Now what did he say? Well, he talks about being submissive, have some submission. We're to be submissive to civil government. That has everything to do with our holiness. But there's another thing about submission he talks about, beginning at verse 18, being submissive to your master. Servants, be submissive. Notice again our word submit. Verse 13, verse 18. To your masters with all fear, not only to the good and the gentle, but also to the harsh. We'll come back to that in a moment. For this is commendable because of the conscience toward God. One endures grief, suffering wrongfully. For what credit is it that you, if you're beaten and you take it patiently, but if you do good and suffer for it, and if you take it patiently, this is commendable before God. Now beginning at verse 21 now. That thought continues on through verse 25, but I want to pick up at verse 21 that he gives Christ as an example of two things. What two things? He willingly submitted to another being, that is to the Father and to his will. Secondly, he endured affliction, which you may do by submitting to the government. You may endure some kind of affliction by submitting to your master. Let's see what he says beginning at verse 21. For to this you were called, because Christ also suffered for us, leaving us an example that we should follow in his steps. What does it mean he's an example? He's our writing copy. You imitate him. You try to do exactly what he did. What did he do? Well, let's begin at verse 22. Who committed nor sin, nor was a guile found in his mouth. And when he was reviled, he did not revile again. And when he suffered, he did not threaten, but committed himself to him who judges righteously, meaning he submitted to the will of the Father. Verse 24, who himself bore our sins in his own body on a tree that we, having died to sin, might live to righteousness. By his stripes we are healed. And then at verse 25, for you were like sheep going astray, but now we have returned to the shepherd and the overseer of our souls. Here's what I want you to see. Let's take those three points found in the context about submission. Submitting to government, submitting to our master, whoever that might be, and Christ is an example both of submission and willingness to suffer. Now I want you to notice something about all three of those. That those principles were true, the context argues, even when someone would be harsh and be threatening. Look at verse 18. Look at verse 18. We're still in the context. Still in the context. Look at verse 18. Servants, be submissive to your master with all fear, not only to the good and gentle, but also to the harsh. Go back to the days when a master would own slaves and own his servants. And you become a Christian and the master owns you. How are you to treat your master? Well, the text says you're still to be obedient to him. Oh, yeah, I know I'm supposed to if he's real good to me. No, no, no. Even if he's harsh, you still be obedient to him. If he's the one that mistreats you, you still be obedient to him. That's what the text said. Look at verse 20. Look at verse 20. Verse 20, for what credit is it if when you are beaten for your fault, you take it patiently? But if you do good and suffer for it, that is, you're mistreated. What good does it do you? It's commendable before God, he said. Look furthermore at verse 23. Look at verse 23. 23, speaking of Christ, He was reviled, yet he did not revile again. He did not threaten, but he committed himself. When he suffered, he did not threaten. So here's the point. In the context, be submissive to the master, be submissive to the government. Christ is an example. That was true even when you were mistreated, the text says. Now let's go to chapter 3, verse 1. Chapter 3, verse 1. Likewise. Notice how he begins. Likewise. What does he mean, likewise? Likewise means something. Likewise, that is just like we have seen in these cases, likewise you wives be submissive. He's been arguing about submission in the context. And just like we were talking about being submissive to government, just like being submissive to your master, and just like Christ set an example, likewise wives are to be submissive to their husbands. Otherwise, likewise means nothing. That's found right here in our context. Now, I know what the command is, and I know the context in which it's said. It has everything to do with being holy. It's in the context of being submissive, and likewise, wives would be submissive. Thirdly, let's talk about the reasons given here in this passage. What reasons? And so a wife says, you know what, I don't know that I want to be submissive. Why should I be? Here's the first. It's an obligation to the Lord, verse 1. God just commanded it. We could stop at that point, and we've accomplished our purpose. But look at verse 1. Likewise, you wives, be submissive. By inspiration, Peter said, likewise, you wives, be submissive. First, it is an obligation of the Lord. Secondly, is the idea of fear. Look at verse 2. She submits because she has fear in her heart. This is not fear like being afraid. She's scared to death of him. In fact, verse 6. Says that ought to be kind of pushed aside, though he might be that harsh husband, because of her trust in God, and we'll come back to that a little bit later if time permits. But let's go back to verse 2. When they observe your chaste conduct accompanied by fear. This may refer to fear that is directed toward God, or it may have reference to fear directed toward her husband. And varied commentators take different approaches to the text. None of which give convincing evidence that they for sure know which it may be. If it is referring to fear of God, and it very well may, then what the text is saying is she submits because she fears God. Why do I need? What's the reason she needs to submit to her husband? Well, it's an obligation of the Lord, number one, verse one. Verse two, because she fears God. She has this awe and respect for God. She is afraid of displeasing God. And because she fears God, not because she fears her husband, but because she fears God, she submits to him, if that's what it's saying. But it could refer to the fear that she has toward her husband. She, after all, is to respect her husband. Let's go to Ephesians chapter 5, if you will. You remember in the passage in Ephesians 5 how wives would be submissive to their own husbands. The text tells us. And in verse 33 it says, let each of you in particular so love his own wife as himself, and let the wife see that she respects, King James says, reverence her husband. She is to respect him. And so if that's what the text in verse 2 of 1 Peter chapter 3 is talking about, then it is saying that she submits to him because she respects him. Well, perhaps these translations may help. The English Standard says, when they observe your respectful and pure conduct. The New American Standard Bible says, her respectful behavior when that's observed. The NET says, her pure and reverent conduct. But others translate it, the fear of God, which of God is not found in the text. Barnes observed this. He said the word fear in this place may refer either to the fear of God or to the proper respect and reverence for their husbands. It very well may. So in either case, what the point is, that she does this because of fear and respect. Respect for whom? It may be because of her respect for God. That's covered in verse 5, by the way, later. Or it may be because she has respect for her husband, that she says, I'm willing to follow his leadership because I respect him. I respect him as the leader. Sarah did that, by the way, verse 5, verse 6. And I want to suggest to you what that means is this involves more than mere submitting. She is not merely submitting to his will, grumbling and complaining all the way, but she willingly does that, respecting his leadership. or at least respecting the fact that God gave that role to her. Here's a third reason. Verse 5, she trusts in God. Why does she do this? Why does she submit? Well, verse 5 says, "For in this manner, in former times, holy women who trusted in God also adorned themselves." How'd they do that? Being submissive to their own husbands. She trusts in God. That means like Sarah and other Old Testament women that verse 5 and verse 6 mention. She trusts in God. It means because of her faith, she's submitting. She's not submitting in spite of her faith. She is submitting to him because of her faith. And when he asks, why do you follow my leadership? Her answer is, if she is this holy person, is because I fear God, because I have faith in God, that's why. And it is because she trusts that God's way is best. You say, how do you know? Let's look at verse 5 and verse 6 again. "For in this manner, in former times, holy women who trusted in God." What do you mean, trusted in God? Well, let me give you an example of that. Look at verse 6. "Sarah obeyed Abraham, calling him Lord, whose daughters you are, if you do good and are not afraid of any terror." That is, she may be submitting to a husband who's harsh, and we'll give evidence of that here in a moment, who's not what he ought to be. She may still submit to him, but she has to trust that God's way is best. And so why does she submit? Because of her trust in God. Now, let me tell you the reason she doesn't submit. It's not because he's the best husband. And so the wife said, you know, I would submit to him if he was really a good husband. But my husband's just not that great, and so I'm not willing to submit to him. Look at 1 Peter chapter 2, 3, our text. Let's go back to our text. Look at verse 1. "Likewise, you wives, be submissive to your own husbands, that even if some do not obey the word." What does that mean? It means he's not a Christian. Did you catch that? Look again at verse 1. "Likewise, you wives, be submissive to your own husbands, that even if what? Some do not obey the word. Means he's not a Christian. So I know in this context, she's not submitting because he's the best husband, because he's not a Christian. Wouldn't a Christian be the best husband? Even those married to non-Christians would have to say, it would be far better if my husband was a Christian. If she's one, at least, she'd say that. Secondly, she is not submitting because he has the best judgment. She didn't say, I'm willing to follow you because I think your judgment is better than what I was saying that we ought to do. And so I'm willing to submit to your leadership because you have the better judgment. I know his judgment isn't the best in this context. You say, how do you know? He's not a Christian. If his judgment was the best, he would have already obeyed the gospel, wouldn't he? She is not submitting because he's the best leader. He may not be the best leader. In fact, he may not be a real good leader. She may even have to help guide him and help him to understand his role as a leader. But she's not submitting because he's the best leader, because he's not a Christian, according to verse 1. But fourth, let's talk about the demeanor. What do we mean by demeanor? By demeanor, I'm talking about, what about the demeanor that helps her to be that submissive person? This is how she does it. This is the attitude that contributes to this submission. And so the wife who's not willing to be submissive and stands back and says, I'm not willing to submit to my husband, is probably lacking in one of these characteristics found in the context. Let's see what they are. What's the demeanor we're talking about? Well, first of all, she is chaste. Look at verse 2. "When they observe your chaste conduct." What does that mean? Thayer says it means pure from every fault, immaculate. In other words, she tries to be a pure woman. That same word is translated pure in several other passages, like Philippians 4 and verse 8. "Whatever things are lovely, whatever things are pure, think on these things," etc. 1 John 3 and in verse 3. That's going to include every facet of life. She's to be pure in her thoughts, Philippians 4 verse 8. We just quoted that. She's to be pure with her tongue, James 3. We don't have the time to develop that. She's to be pure in her deeds, and I cite the very text we're studying, verses 2 and 3. In every aspect of her life, that demeanor contributes to her submissive attitude. But that's not the only thing. Look at verses 3 and 4. And this is this inward adorning. Her adorning is inward and not outward. Look at verse 3. He said, "Do not let your beauty be the outward adorning of the arranging of hair and wearing of gold and putting on a fine apparel, but let it be the hidden person of the heart, which is incorruptible." of a gentle and quiet spirit, which is very precious in the sight of God. Let's talk about this gentle and quiet spirit. The word gentle, according to R.C.H. Trench, he says that it means simply it's a temper of spirit in which we accept his dealings with us as good, that is God's dealing with us as good, and therefore without dispute or resisting. Let's go back to the context. You are to submit to your government. Yeah, the Roman government at the time. That is not the best government. That is not so friendly toward Christianity. You submit to the government. And so here's a role God has given me. Of submitting to my master, for example. And submitting to my husband who's not a Christian. And so what this gentleness has to do with, it's the same word for meekness. It accepts God's dealing with us as good without my resisting that and saying, I'm not going to do that. She is one who is gentle. It is the spirit that submits to God without question and without complaint. It is the attitude of Matthew 26, 42 that was read to us this morning in our scripture reading. And that is where Jesus said, nevertheless, not as I will, but as you will. Remember that prayer in the Garden of Gethsemane? It's that attitude. It means she also submits to her husband without resistance. She accepts God's dealings with us, but she also submits to him and to his leadership without resisting against God and against him. But the word quiet in our text, let's go back to our text at verse 3, verse 4. A gentle and quiet spirit. There says it means tranquil. Vine says it indicates tranquility arising from within, causing no disturbance to others. It is translated peaceable in 1 Timothy 2 and in verse 2. Like what Barnes says at this juncture, he said, this is of a calm temper, a contented mind, a heart free from passion, pride, and envy, and irritability. A soul not subject to the agitation and vexations of those who live for fashion and who seek to be distinguished for external adorning. What Barnes is saying is the person whose emphasis is merely on the outward, and that's where her adorning is, that's what she focuses on. She's not interested in the inner person, but she's only interested in the outward. The day she wakes up with a bad hair day or things don't go well in getting her makeup on, or maybe the clothes just don't fit right or look right, she is beside herself. But the woman of a gentle and quiet spirit is the kind who is interested not so much on the outward adorning, but the inward adorning of this meek and quiet spirit. Now, this passage is not forbidding her, let's go back to verse 3, for wearing of gold or fixing her hair. Let me give you a parallel to show you how this construction works. In John 6, Jesus said, labor not for meat that perishes. What's the meat that perishes? That's the steak, the literal steak you buy at Kroger. He said, don't labor for that. You mean I can't work and get money and go to Kroger and buy hamburger meat and steak and meat that perishes? I can't do that? No, that's what Jesus was saying. Though that's what he's talking about. But he said, labor for the meat that endures to everlasting life. What's his point? His point is, this is not to be your emphasis. This over here is to have the greater emphasis. He's not saying we can't work for food. In fact, 2 Thessalonians 3:10 says we should. Now look at the parallel. Her adorning is not to be the outward adorning of the arranging of hair, putting on gold, or putting on a fine apparel. Is that forbidding the wearing of apparel? No. Or wearing of gold, not fixing her hair. But her emphasis is to be the hidden person of the heart. That's where her emphasis is. And when that's the case, what we're suggesting is that spirit, that demeanor, contributes to her willingly submitting. Let's suggest the fact from the context, back to 1 Peter 3, she is a disciplined woman. Let me just list a few things that tell me she's disciplined. She watches what she says. The woman who is undisciplined, who doesn't not careful of what she says and what she does, is out not to be submissive to her husband. This woman watches what she says, even without a word, may be won by the conduct of the wives. She's careful about how she nags her husband. She's careful about what she says to him about his not obeying the gospel yet. She's careful she's not preaching to him all the time. She watches what she says. That's not all. She watches her example at home, verses 1 and 2. There's something else. She's sincere, according to verse 4. Because she's giving emphasis to the inward and not just the outward. She's not a hypocrite. And she controls her temperament, according to verse 3 and verse 4. But the demeanor, verse 6 is the respect and the honor she has for her husband. As Sarah obeyed Abraham, calling him Lord. Genesis 18 and verse 12. Hamilton suggested this juncture and captured the thought when he said, Peter uses this address, that is Lord, to show the proper regard and respect in which Sarah held Abraham as her husband. That she held him in respect. That's the point he's trying to make. And when she has this respect and honor, when her demeanor is she's pure, and when her demeanor is she has this inward adorning, and she's a disciplined person, and she has respect and honor, then she's going to willingly submit. And finally, let's talk about the results. And the lesson will be yours. What about the results? Let's list four. When she willingly submits to her husband, number one, verse one says, she now in verse two has a powerful influence on an unbelieving husband. There are wives who are married to non-Christian men and who say, you know, what could I do? I've talked to him, I've preached to him, I've threatened him, I've done everything, and I don't know how I can convert him. Well, what you just mentioned there was just all the wrong things to do. It's not ever going to work. And how do you know? Because that's what Peter said, verses 1 and 2. Let's look at verses 1 and 2. Likewise, you wives, be submissive to your husbands, that even if some do not obey the word, they're not Christians, they without a word from the wife, that is, may be won by the conduct, by the example of the wife. What example? Number 1, verse 1 says she's submissive to her husband. Number 2, verse 2 says he observes her chaste conduct accompanied by fear. When he comes to realize she's submitting herself to my leadership, not because she thinks I'm the best man, because I'm the best leader, she's submitting to me because of her relationship to God. She's respecting me because of her relationship to God. That is a powerful influence on an unbelieving husband. Secondly, the result is she pleases God. Look at verse 4. But let it be the hidden person of the heart with the incorruptible ornament of a gentle and quiet spirit, which is very precious in the sight of God. You know, there are things that you think of as very precious and some that are not. Here's something very precious in the sight of God. God looks at that and he values it great. It pleases God. Thirdly, she's doing good. Look at verse 6. Sarah obeyed Abraham, calling him Lord, whose daughters you are. In other words, you're just like her. If you do good, what you talked about in the context, being submissive, verse 1, verse 5, verse 6. And finally, you have the divine adorning. Her adorning is not outward, but she adorns herself with something else. Look at verse 5. For in this manner, former women, in former times, holy women who trusted in God also adorned themselves. How did they adorn themselves? Well, not by the putting on of gold on the fine apparel and the wearing of their hair in a certain way. But look at verse 5, being submissive to their own husbands. That is, when they submitted to their husbands, that was adorning themselves. They were putting as if they were putting a garment upon themselves. They're putting a spiritual garment on. They've decorated themselves in a spiritual fashion by being this woman that is described here in our context. So what have we seen in our study tonight? A study of 1 Peter chapter 3, verses 1 through 6, submission to husbands. We've seen the command. We've seen the context. The command is be submissive. The context is being holy and being submissive. We saw the reasons given in the context. We saw the demeanor that contributes to that and the result that follows. Now let's go back just for a moment to why this material is needed. Can you see that this text helps us to understand the fallacy of every one of those? This text helps me to see the feminist movement that says you're not to submit to any man is all wrong. I see from this context this false notion that submission makes you an inferior person is all wrong. And in the home and in the family, and it may be in your home where the wife is domineering and controlling and wears the pants in the family and she tells the husband the way things will be is all wrong. Because 1 Peter 3 gives a different picture. There may be one or more present this evening who's not a Christian, who's not a child of God. Would you come believing that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of the living God? Would you repent of your sins, acknowledge your faith, and be buried in the waters of baptism for the remission of sins? There may be an erring child of God who needs to make correction. If you're subject in any way, would you come while together we stand and sing?